no heat, and in the winter.
Do you want to do an introduction to our episode?
Oh, but of course.
You just say, like...
What do you want me to say? Here at Carmine Street Guitars, our podcast coming up. When is it coming up?
It'll be out.
It'll be out soon.
We
got a mess of episodes.
Yeah, but what...
Time is on our side.
Tell everybody who's in the room with you right now.
Yeah. Rick, what are we talking about today? I think...
Today I think we're going to talk a little bit about Robert Quine, my old buddy Quine.
Yeah, it's Robert Quine. Who is Robert Quine for people who don't know?
Oh, yeah, Bob Robert Quine.
One of the best guitarists.
He was from Akron, Ohio, and... he became a lawyer, didn't want to do that, but he was always playing guitar. He had an amazing amount of different influences in his guitar playing.
He played and with Richard Hell and the Voidoids.
He was one of the first Voidoids, got into the punk scene, playing CBGBs in the early 70s.
Lou Reed.
But he was he a lawyer? He came to New York and was a lawyer.
Yeah, he was a lawyer. I never knew that. Yeah.
He got a law degree.
I don't know if he ever really practiced law. He had a law degree, and then I think he just started getting jobs as a guitarist. And, yeah, then he was into Lou Reed's band in the 80s, early 80s, I think it started, maybe even late 70s.
Well, and, what really put him on the scene? Did he ever, like, what was his moment where everybody was like, who is this guy?
People? Yeah, yeah. I wonder if it was just the Voidoids exposure. I think playing it was CBs.
I mean, the Voidoids had to have started that with him because, I mean, that was how I got into Quine. When I was like 15, I heard the Voidoids album and I just went, who is that? And I had no idea that you knew him.
I mean, he was on the scene for a long time. He, in the 60s, you know, we have the Quine tapes here, which Bob actually recorded with a handheld reel-to-reel on his shoulder.
Yeah, he recorded the Velvet Underground.
Velvet Underground, before they were anybody, so good. And nobody knew them. And he was in a club with this thing on his shoulder recording them. And then many, many years later, in the 90s, I actually asked Lou if it was okay to put these out as the Quine tapes. And that's what happened. And they are out. I don't know if they're still even in print.
They, I think you can get it online, actually. I think it's even on Spotify.
He was in the scene really early in the 60s, even. He was playing guitar. James Burton was a big influence, and Ricky Nelson's guitar player, and Elvis and those guys, you know, so many guitar players influenced him. And then like guys like Albert Eiler, he was a huge fan of. But there's a couple of guys here that are in the city that were good friends of Quine, you know, Jody, and of course in the Voidoids, you got Ian, and trying to think of everybody who's early friends. And then Bill Frisell and Mark Rebo, those guys were good friends of Bob's. And
another album that you have. What's that one that's like the bootleg one that's not even out?
Of what?
The dinner party.
Oh, yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah.
I've got
just some, you know, Quine was really good with making tapes. If you showed interest, he would go home and make you a tape.
Wow.
A little cassette.
And you've got tons of them here.
I got tons of them here, but... I remember him bringing them in for people who were regulars here and would hang out.
I'd love to digitize some of that, and we should play some of this.
I know, because I don't have the machine now.
I
always worried about that. Yeah, I'm losing these because they're getting all dusty, and I got to go through and find them all. But there's a lot of stuff there, and a lot of his records, too. There's a couple of versions, practice versions of the Voidoids playing at CB's, you know, practicing and shit. And then jamming at his house with Rebo and
so good.
And Frisell.
They're all really good. Yeah, and then he really would different. Also make you like...
Oh, yeah, really obscure 50s stuff, you know, that you would never have heard of even.
Like weird regional acts that just...
Just all kinds of stuff.
Just
songs that he really liked. He would put them together on these long cassettes, you know, that are just really cool music. And like I say, he had so many, all the blues guys, you know, and then he liked the weird ones like Pee Wee Creighton and Clarence Garlow. And, you know, he would make me go buy, he would make me give him money because he was always in a record store.
I was just going to bring that up.
Every day was a record store somewhere. It was part of his routine. And he would go to bookstores to buy cookbooks and record stores to buy records and cassettes and whatever was at the time. But yeah, he would make me give him money, and then he would say, "Now you have to have Miles Davis. You have to have this box set. It just came out. Give me the money." And then he would go get it because he just loved to shop, you know.
Make sure you're educated.
Yeah, even back when Tower Records was still over on Broadway, I remember him going over to get me something that was on sale that I had to have, you know. But I'm so glad I did because, you know, now I have all the Rolling Stones that, you know, wow. I actually have in vinyl, but I never had in cassettes or VCRs, VDVs, whatever the hell they're called.
But it sounds like...
Even if I'm using Rick's cell phone still, he's like, "You're going to waste my film. Stop it."
Waste my film.
Like recording video or something.
On his phone?
Taking too many shots.
Like, what film, Rick?
But, I mean, how would you describe his guitar playing style? Because it seems like he came up with a group of people who have like really, like when I think of like Bill Frisell or like Mark Rebo, these are like people who are like steeped in Americana of like the blues and like traditional playing. Yeah. But there's like something like a...
I always wonder like who influenced who when it comes to those three. Because there's a lot of similarities between the three of them. But yet they're all completely different.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see a lot of the same thing. And I don't know. I think Quine, you'd have to say he stretched out more. Even as conservative he was, he could, you know, really let it out there and be, like, super innovative, you know, and just let things happen. Improvise, that's the word I'm looking for. He loved jazz, too. He Miles and Coltrane and all that, we had to have that here. Even though he didn't necessarily want to listen to it here.
Right.
And he was such an underground player, too. But when you hear it, you know it's him.
Yeah, for sure.
You know it's him. Yeah. Like, he's one of those people.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The style, how they develop their differences is always as fascinating because it's the same
And it's
instrument.
A bit chaotic.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's playing.
Maybe that's
he adds a little bit of chaos to whatever he's doing, but it's like a very finessed, like, way. I don't know how to... true, you know? It's like his solos and stuff. I mean, what happened?
Like frenetic, noisy. Maybe that's like from watching the Velvets too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he had all kinds of influences that influenced his playing. And he loved to meet the players. And, you know, when he did meet somebody, like he would remember something about, like something happened in the 1950s maybe with them or something on some set. And he knew it. And he was like a historian when it came to records and other musicians, and when he got to meet one of them, I remember here when GE would come in, him and Bob would immediately go out and they'd start talking. And then there was one day here when Bob was here with Patty Smith, and Bob sat here and had about a 2-hour conversation. And of course, I had no recording devices or cell phones or anything, and it's just all in my head. But that was one of the best times here, I think.
They were just talking about music.
And tripping and going here and there and playing with this one and that one and what it's like to, you know, I met him and I played there with him and, you know, different concerts that they crossed paths at. Yep. Okay.
Sex was on the slide. I couldn't keep my hands off me.
What is it?
Chicks can't live without the credit card machine. She don't have no money.
Chicks? Why is it a chick thing? Uh-oh, we're doing this again.
Oh, it's not really. That was
a, oh, my that was God. Only, she was Rick's in trouble.
I'm in trouble again.
The chicks are going to get real mad
the
with you, Rick.
The bicephalus serpent will be getting me.
So we're talking about Robert... Bob Quine.
Bob Quine.
We're talking about Robert Quine. Oh, yeah, but Quine also used to come in here and like quiz people about things like, oh, what amp is this or something on different. So, didn't he? You were telling me about that with, I don't know, like Phil or
yeah,
something.
Maybe like with Phil or some of the guys he got to really know well, especially yeah. Phil, because
yeah.
You know, it was so, he would be so aghast
Phil,
that
Phil's
Phil
a guy
grew
that,
up here.
Tell people and, who Phil is real quick.
Yeah, he's just a guy that used to
he's
hang out
used
here
to
in
hang
the shop.
Here.
He grew up in up
Made
in Harlem.
And stuff because
and
of Quine.
A local guy plays yeah. a little guitar, and he was always trying to get Quine. He was always picking Quine's brain.
Yeah.
And only if Bob was kind of getting a little tipsy after about three or four airline bottles, he would start answering Phil.
Oh, otherwise, he would drink the airline bottles of liquor?
Yeah, yeah.
He'd come
when
in
he had a few of those, he got more friendly and open about, you know, telling stories or actually teaching. But he would also quiz you a little bit. And he couldn't believe that Phil grew up here and didn't even know who Buddy Holly was or didn't know who Roy Orbison was. Like, we were like, who's this, Phil? I don't know. Freaking Roy Orbison, you know, so obvious who it is. But that used to blow his mind, so he did it often, you know. He was always quizzing. Kind of goofing on you that you didn't know those things that you should know.
What time period is this? When what years did he come by? The
90s. He started 90s. Coming here in the early 90s, 92, 91, 92. And the first thing he did was buy a bunch of strap lock buttons. And he bought like five. He's got to have at least five guitars. You know, maybe he is a customer. I didn't know who he was. And then I think he came back the next day and bought like 14 more. And then I said, oh, this he's an eccentric. Okay. Here we go. So it was from that time on that we got to be friends. And, you know, he was playing with Lou just before that, up into the early 90s. He was still in Lou's entourage, traveling and on the road a lot. And
was that after you made a guitar for Lou?
Yeah, I had already made guitars for Lou back in the 80s. You know,
didn't you know him from the Downing Street
shop? From
the
70s, yeah. I
Rick
actually
had a
started,
shop
yeah,
called working. Naked City Guitars on Downing Street.
Yeah.
The sign's up here in the shop.
Yeah, it's the sign. It was
37 Downing.
Yeah, oh, that yeah. was 1976 through 79. I was around the corner, but I didn't know Quine then.
No, but you met Lou then.
Yes,
no?
Yeah. His yeah. guitar player.
And Bowie.
Happened to live on my on that block, on, and I used to talk to Lou about him because he didn't last long in Lou's band, but he was there for a couple of years with Lou, and he used to bring Lou's Roland synthesizer guitars over to the shop, and I'd work on those and set those up, and then I got to talking to Lou, and he bought a couple of my guitars. But what was I saying about Quine before that?
Well, when he used to come in the shop and buy, when he first
yeah,
came
yeah,
in,
first
he would...
started coming in, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's what we were talking about with the strap buttons and all. But then I realized he, you know, had amassed all these 52 Tele guitars that were like reissues at the time, and he was buying them because he was making really good money with Lou. And you know, we got to talking about Teles because I'm a big Tele fan too, And then it was like we both had an admiration for Roy Buchanan and not necessarily Danny Gatton. And that was what hit it off with us. You know? It was like, all right, Kelly, you got nothing to prove, so I'll hang out here.
And he would just come in and
hang out? Every day. He was the regular. He was sitting right where you are every single day. And then he would put some music on, go get a couple of little bottles, spend a lot of time in the bathroom, and call Alice, or Alice would call here, and they would...
Who's Alice?
His wife.
His wife.
They would discuss how much they drank so far today, and will you bring a bottle home or no, or, you know, it was always the same conversation every day about how much they're going to drink or how much they already had to drink. And they were trying to keep it under control, I think, you know, but it was curious to me just overhearing those conversations. But
he also used to buy, like, tell them about, like, the Epiphone casinos and stuff.
Oh, yeah, when he started buying guitars, and especially after Alice passed away. When Alice died, I remember the day he called me up and he said, Alice is in the tub. And I went, so? And he goes, she's not moving. And I said, well, did you turn the water on her and slap her around a little better? And just try to wake her up. What's going on? You know. And then it was like, no, I think she's dead. And I went, you want me? I'll come right over. He goes, no, I already called the ambulance. They're here now. I hear them, and then I'll talk to you later. And yeah, and that was it. And he was totally different after that. You know, for months and months, he was. Just wanted to commit suicide. He had it on his mind that that's what he was going to do. They had evidently had a kind of a pact between the two of them. First one to go, the other one would follow. But I kept telling him that he was going to fuck it up, and he was going to be in a hospital, brain dead, for the rest of trying to scare him into not doing it, you know?
Right.
But eventually he figured it out. But it was a long, painful time for him, you know? He kept playing, though, and he started playing with Kazuyoshi, and they would actually bring him over to Japan, and I think that was
Kazuyoshi
the last band.
Saito.
Yeah,
Kazuyoshi. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but yeah.
I was listening actually to some of that as I was thinking about talking about this with you. It's just, like, gorgeous stuff. It's really good.
Yeah, he's so huge in Japan, Kazuyoshi. But they loved Quine, and he so wanted him in his band. And paid him a lot of money and brought him over. More? Okay.
Oh, hang on.
All right.
So he'd come in the shop and play a lot?
No, like, hardly ever. And he used to, like... he would get on your case if you were out there just, you know. He actually told, I wouldn't even mention names, but he told a couple of guitarists to go home and masturbate at home, not here in the show.
Like famous guitarists?
Pretty famous, yeah.
You were not going to mention names on that.
Yeah, he was pretty brutal and honest, you know. And I think that's why him and Lou got along for a while, but also why they butted heads and broke up in the end. Like, you know.
Both pretty opinionated, stubborn guys.
Yeah, very much so, you know.
Did you get to see him play at all when...
I think I did see him in CBGB's back in the 70s, but I didn't know him then.
Yeah.
But I did see the band.
Voidoids.
A few bands. I saw the Voidoids. I saw Patty play there a couple of times. And a few other bands that I don't even remember who they were.
And then you had whatchamacallit?
What?
With the bus in front of CBGB.
Oh, yeah. Alan Woody.
Yeah.
And the government mule guys. Yeah, that's a great story.
What's that story?
Alan was a good friend of the shop, and he was, he bought a bunch of guitars for me, had me make him a couple of things. They were big Chris Whitley fans, and I made Alan a bass like shaped in the downsized Explorer that I had made for Chris. And then he wanted me to make one for Warren, and then he passed away. But anyway, one day when I was delivering a guitar, he said, I'm playing at CB's tonight, come on over and bring it, you know, when you're done, because I had to finish setting it up or something. So I go over, and they're standing outside the tour bus, And he said, come on the bus. I said, all right. So you follow him on the bus, and a couple of guys on the bus smoking big hookahs, you know. We go to the back of the bus, and there's a gigantic marijuana plant hanging upside down. I guess, you know, it's still not legal in New York City. You know? He goes, what are you talking about? It's not a problem. You know, that was funny. Those guys were nuts, man. Right on.
That's really funny. Yeah,
right in front of CB's big tour bus. Pot smoke coming out the windows like you wouldn't believe.
So is I wanted to ask, is there like any recordings of Quine that you feel like, I don't know, represent him the best?
Yeah, or I think, like, you know, this is the Blank Generation soundtrack.
Yeah.
And you know, just the song, the Blank Generation song, is so Quine. You couldn't pick a better song that describes his wild, crazy playing, you know, which is really what I think makes him so different. Because he could play anything. He could just carry rhythm. He was a really good rhythm guitar player and took a lot of pride in learning how to be a good rhythm guitar player. Hmm. But his leads were just, you know, outrageously out there, and that's what he wanted to do. He didn't want to just do a typical lead, you know. His leads were really innovative.
What is it about that song that is like
the Blank Generation?
Yeah, so
well, because it's the lead, you know, it's just such a crazy lead that you wouldn't normally get away with if you were a guitarist, you know.
I don't know what they did on the new Richard Hell album. They like re-released this year or something, and I feel like they like toned Quine down so much. I don't know if it.
I don't think it's even him. Yeah, I think they
replaced. Like, I don't know what they
that
did.
Used to bother Bob so much,
right?
Too.
Ivan's still in that, but.
Yeah,
would they mix him lower?
Yeah, they would mix him out. Like Lou did it a few times, and I think that was really the cause of their split, was because Lou, you know, decided he wasn't going to have that lick on there, and it was. I think a lot of times it just takes over the song, and if you're not willing, like the Voidoids were, to let Bob control that narrative, they would tone it down or take it out, and it used to piss him off something fierce. He would just quit. And never talk to you again if you did that to his music.
Wow.
You know, he was really passionate about what was recorded.
But yeah, he was never the type to like have his own band or
and
project.
He never would show off, you know, playing in the shop or any of that, no. Hmm. Yeah, he was, you know, really admirable that way as far as, you know, being his own man and confident as he was. He didn't need to show off.
Yeah. Do you ever talk about working with, like, Eno at all?
Probably, but I don't remember.
No.
Yeah, he didn't really talk too much about being in different bands and what they did, or unless it was something that was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He never talked about the good times. He was always too damn depressed about everything, you know. He didn't listen to new music. It was like there was nothing new. Everything's been done. And I'm going, yeah, Bob, but listen to these guys, man. You know, and it was like, yeah. He would walk out. He would just leave, you know. And then he really thought that music had all been done already.
Yeah.
And to be really different and creative was going to take some kind of really big, you know, shift of the planet or something.
That's so interesting because he was doing something new.
That's what I feel like. Yeah.
You know, that's a funny attitude to have because he, you hear him play, it doesn't sound like anybody. It sounds like him.
Yeah, right.
That's what I was saying before when I first heard it. I was in my aunt and uncle's basement when I lived there, and I put that album on for the first time. And even by 15, I'd heard so much punk. I mean, I was so into it. I started going to shows when I was like 9 or 10. And when I heard that album, I mean, his guitar playing, especially growing up with guitar playing, I just went, oh, who's this guy? Like, he's fucking great, you know?
He was really into pedals too, you know?
So yeah.
His pedal collection was really vast, and he was always into new pedals. And, you know, when all his gear came here, I couldn't believe how many boxes, I mean, big boxes full of pedals he had. Because he was obsessive that way. If he had a cookbook he'd like, he'd go buy 30 of the same cookbook. If there was a pedal he'd like, he'd buy 30. I have a couple of them
that Rick gave me.
Yeah, he was, and then he started here with the guitars. He started, you know, I knew if I would get another, I was an Epiphone dealer at the time, and he was into Epiphone casinos. And he had two or three already. He had got from Mojo, and, you know, he saw one here, he liked, he bought it. And then every time one would come, I'd get another replacement or one or two. And I'd say, Bob, I got a new one. Don't take it out of the box. I'll be right over. And he'd come over and strum it across, holding it horizontal. And if it sounded a certain way, he would take it.
Wow.
And then sometimes it got to the point where he had 13 or 14 already, and he didn't even want it out of the box. He would just buy it anyway. And then he got into the Gitans and started doing the same thing with the Gitans, the gypsy guitars. He must have bought 10 or 12 of those from me. And every time I got a new one, it was the same procedure. And then one day he wanted me to come up to look at a crack in one of his guitars. This is after Alice died. And I go up to his apartment, his loft over on Grand Street. And here's all these guitars laid out. Most of the flat cases on the floor with the case open, the guitar in it. And other, you know, the whole floor was covered with guitar cases with the tops open. And then he had a stand and a chair in front of the stand. And I knew what he was doing. He was put one in the new stand. He would sit there and stare at it until he got tired of it. And then he'd go buy another one. And it was that kind of crazy obsession that he started doing, you know, after Alice died. And I guess he was so messed up and lonely inside that the guitars were the only answer to relieving that pain. Yeah. But that was crazy. And the collection, he had this room that he would record in his loft, and it was all isolated for sound, and it had about a 10-foot space on top before it hit the top of the ceiling. And it was just filled with Tweed cases. I'll never forget, it must have been hundreds of them there. And his wall of records, which was like a 40-foot wall from the floor to the ceiling, 15 feet of records. You know, I don't know how you would ever find anything. Nothing was labeled. There were just millions of records. And then, you know, I have this photo of him standing in front of his cassette collection, which was also a wall, just a wall of cassettes. You know, and I was like, wow.
Well, it seems like that, like, obsessiveness is kind of like also what helped him be so creative and prolific.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he spent a lot of time in that little room where he had his sound system set up. And he didn't have the big mixing boards or any of that stuff, but he had all his pedals. And I think he had like one little mixer, as I remember.
And he would just make tape, like play guitar and make tapes and write.
And he was doing a soundtrack for like a really avant-garde soundtrack at the time, too, before he passed away. And it was really cool because it was all weird feedbacks and things. And I don't remember what the movie was that he was doing it for, but he wouldn't do anything unless you paid him really good. He would never play in a club unless he got paid good. And he said, those days are over. I'm not walking down the street with an amplifier and a guitar anymore.
I mean, I don't blame him.
Yeah.
It was a tough business even back then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
How many years, what year did he die?
I don't remember now, 2006, 2004, something over there, I think.
So he was coming to the shop for like 15 years or something, right?
Yeah, more than 10 years. He was here every day. Yeah, I think it was this 2 weeks he went to Japan. I never forgot when he came back. I had these pictures of him going through customs. And they made him open up this suitcase, and it was filled from the bottom to the top. It's a big suitcase with Zippo lighters because you could only buy certain ones in Japan that you couldn't get.
I was going to bring that up before.
I couldn't believe how many Zippos. And then when, you know, after he died, I had to go up and identify the body. You know, I'm kind of the guy who found him dead. And the narc was there, you know, smoking a big cigar because he was starting to smell pretty bad. But they were going through the drawers, you know, and he had made a note saying what had happened, But there was drawers filled to the top with Zippo lighters everywhere you looked, and a huge pipe collection.
He would smoke pipes?
I never saw him smoke a pipe, but he had a huge pipe collection. Yeah, and they looked like he was smoking in his apartment. You know, he had the ashtrays and all. You know, I know from my grandfather growing up, he was a pipe smoker too, and I know what that looks like, you know. And he had certain ashtrays for that. But I don't think he ever smoked a pipe in here. Maybe once or twice. Hardly ever. Yeah.
Well, he passed out a couple of times in here.
Yeah, he passed out on the floor. Dorothy. I remember when my mom came back one day and she goes, "Who's that man on the floor?" And I said, "Oh, that's just Bob. Don't worry about him." But he would just drink himself till he fell off the stool and lay on the floor and throw up. And you know, I didn't want to, you know, I had it after a while. I wasn't about to wake him up, just let him sit there, you know. But he would leave here sometimes and he would aim. He would aim himself on the high side of the sidewalk. And by the time he got halfway down the block, he was already in the curb.
Oh, my God.
And I'm going, he'll never make it home. Next day, he'd come in and he goes, "Yeah, I woke up in front of my apartment. I was on the sidewalk."
Oh, my God.
Spent the night on the sidewalk in front of his apartment. Made it that far and he couldn't get in.
One of the interesting things I think about him is how little people know his name, but have probably heard him play guitar on a song.
Yeah, I mean, he was Marianne Faithfull Records, Tom Waits, Matthew Sweet.
So actually, many, that was my introduction to him, and I didn't know probably until a decade after.
Mm.
He played on Girlfriend.
Yeah.
And that guitar solo is, super influential on the way I play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I realized he influenced me, and I didn't even know who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, he did that to a lot of people, I think. You know, he was, he never had his own solo album. He never got recognition. He was always the side man, you know. He was like a Tommy Tedesco, you know, kind of guy. But he wasn't doing, sessions. He wasn't, playing in that kind of scene. He was in bands, you know. But
he'd just show up and play when somebody called him.
Yeah, as long as you paid them good, yeah.
There's some really cool, I don't know if you, I think I showed you once, Rick, but I ended up, when they came out years ago, with the punk magazine, like, archive, like, hardcover book of all the punk magazines in New York and stuff that they came out with. And Quine's, they have Quine in some of the stories with, like, I think it was the Monster Beach Party one with like Joey Ramone and Debbie Harry and all that, whole New York scene.
Oh, yeah.
But I have to, I don't know. I have to pull those up because I think you can find them online, but they're pretty cool. But even that kind of stuff, it's like you find them in these places that you don't expect, really.
Yeah, he's like kind of ubiquitous. That's kind of why I wanted to talk about him because, he's like so ubiquitous in music for like, three decades.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and even like archiving music with like the Quine tapes.
Yeah.
Like here's this guy and he's like, I don't know, like music would not be the same if he did not exist. You know?
For sure.
And his footprint looms so large and he's just like one of those people that like people don't know his name.
Yeah.
You know, here's this guy, he comes in the shop, has some drinks, talks about music, like, you know, just this really unassuming guy.
Yeah. But
like,
I mean, I got so excited when I found out that Rick knew him, because before I started here, I had no idea that he knew Quine. And when I started here, I'm listening to BGO, and Rick's just like putting blues records on all day. That I'm just like, at that point, I was like, I don't want to hear this. Like, he got me into the blues, really. I was on a whole nother planet, but when he said he knew Robert Quine, I was going, what? I was like, this is like unexpected. Even that kind of a thing was funny for me. But yeah, it's so cool.
Yeah. I think that's enough for an episode there.
Sounds good to me.
You want to tell people thanks for listening?
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Will you say like and subscribe or something like that?
I don't know, like and subscribe.
Or
to
leave us a review or something.
Leave us a review on our podcast. Tell us what you think.
Yeah,
it helps, right? I don't know how that stuff works, but.
It helps.
It helps. It helps, Rick.
It helps. Do it for Quine's memory.
Yeah, do it for Quine. Do it for Quine. Yeah. Do it for Rick. You know,
they should do it for Quine. Send it around because he's great. Going down to
in your ear. Podcast Network.